Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Eugene Scalia, representing the petitioner. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The decision of the National Labor Relations Board in this case violates two of the most fundamental principles of our labor laws. First, the principle that we prefer resolution of disputes through arbitration rather than through resort to economic weapons. Second, the decision conflicts as well with the principle that when economic weapons are brought into play, employers, as well as employees, have what the Supreme Court has called economic weapons in reserve.
Mr. Scalia, is that what this case is really about? Isn't this case really about just trying to understand what the parties meant when they used this phrase, memorial periods? Don't we have to get to that issue first before we can get
that? That is a threshold issue, Your Honor, although the resolution of that is extremely important to the national policy favoring arbitration, which is what the Gateway Coal case and the Lucas Flower case about it beforehand.
So we have to decide whether there's something about the phrase memorial periods that's an express rejection of the agreement not to strike over arbitrable periods. Right? That's the nub of it, right?
Exactly, Your Honor.
And how in the world do you get around the stipulation paragraph 17 that your predecessor counsel agreed to?
Your Honor, I would submit that to state the question as you've done is to answer this case and to hold for Chevron. You said, where is the express statement? There is none. Express statement means in the text, explicit in the Supreme Court's words. The Supreme Court in Gateway Coal said that all doubts are resolved in favor of finding that there can't be a strike. The Supreme Court said there must be forceful evidence.
If we were to look to paragraph 17 of the stipulation, and I know you're telling us we shouldn't look to that. Is that your point?
Well, I am. Express means on the face of the document.
Let's imagine we do look at it. What do we find when we look at Stipulation 17? Maybe we're not supposed to look at it, and I'll hear you on that in a minute. But
I would say that when it needs to be explicit, and when doubts are resolved in favor of finding a no-strike obligation, that ends the matter. If you look at that paragraph, however, I don't think you find anything that dictates a different conclusion. First, again, the burden remains very, very heavy on the board here. They haven't cited a single case in the annals of American jurisprudence where step one was met. There's a no-strike agreement. But step two is met as well. There can be a strike. They don't have a single case.
Just to continue Judge Griffith's questions, isn't the problem the stipulation your client made before the board that the decisions that are attached to the stipulation reflect the purpose of the memorial clause? And one of those decisions is a West Virginia case which says that it can be used to do a work stoppage on an arbitrable issue, and your client stipulated that was in fact something that could be done under the memorial clause.
Respectfully, Your Honor, they stopped short of saying that the meaning is reflected in those decisions. Uh-huh. They said the decisions address it. That's indisputable. These decisions address the contract just as Lochner v. New York addresses the meaning of the due process.
What did Arch say, the West Virginia case, what did Arch say about the meaning of the phrase memorial periods?
It says that it's broad, it could mean anything. And I would submit that is insufficient. Gateway Coal has a heartland where there is an elevated standard. Gateway Coal does not care whether workers in West Virginia want to go deer hunting and use the memorial period provision for that purpose, which is what the board twice said was the issue in the West Virginia case. They wanted to go deer hunting. The company said it's not authorized under the contract. They said, well, we're going to take Memorial Days. We're going deer hunting.
Gateway Coal doesn't care about that. They did that in order to put pressure on the company to negotiate that issue. In other words, they did exactly what happened here. Sure, that was the arbitrable issue, the deer hunting, but they used the Memorial Days, quote, in order to put pressure on the employer in the negotiations, just like this case.
Respectfully, Judge Shadle, I don't think that's what happened. They went deer hunting. They took those days, they went deer hunting. That's what the board twice said was done. But again, to take a single decision by a district court in West Virginia, which did not even address the Gateway Coal standard, it cited the case, didn't address the standard, didn't acknowledge the burden, to take that case involving other parties, a single district court decision.
The value of the case is not in terms of its precedential value or anything. It's an insight into what the parties meant by memorial periods. And the parties are saying, this is what we, you want to know what we meant by memorial periods? Look at these cases.
Right? Respectfully, Judge Griffith, I don't think you can say that for a couple of different reasons. First of all, there's no evidence that the parties here, Chevron particularly, was aware of this decision, intended to adhere to that decision at the time that it entered its agreement. No evidence of it. And the parties have tacitly conceded that you can't use different parties' collective bargaining agreement to buy the parties. But moreover,
in Chevron's brief before the board, it specifically relied on the stipulation, and particularly the Pittston Memorial, the Pittston opinion. It specifically relied on that for its assertion of what the Memorial Clause meant.
Judge Shadle, we certainly have acknowledged those decisions are out there, that they opine on what...
I said your client relied on it.
I believe the Pittston decision was a decision by the board itself, the office advice, which did not hold that it could be used to exert economic pressure.
Of course it didn't. And that's why, before the board, Chevron relied on it to support its position. I only mention it because you said that there's no evidence that Chevron was aware of these, whereas I'm just pointing out that before the board, Chevron relied on this to support its view of the what the clause meant.
Judge Shadle, my point is there's no evidence that at the time they entered the collective bargaining agreement in issue, that they were aware of these decisions and intended to implement it. And in fact, when you look at the record, the only evidence of memorial period being used as against Chevron for purposes of economic pressure on pending arbitral disputes, which is the heartland of Gateway Coal and the one area where Gateway Coal applies a heightened standard, the sole evidence of that is that on six occasions at one mine in one district, it was done. There's no evidence it was ever done before as against Chevron. And when it was done, what the record shows is that within less than a year, Chevron responded by changing its agreement. To summarize on these points, we certainly noted that they addressed the law. We didn't say that they correctly addressed, that these were binding. But none of this elevates you to the...
What was the purpose of that stipulation? That when you say they noted that they addressed the issue. I mean,
The nature of so many stipulations, and I didn't negotiate it, but we know how these things work. You had on the one side the general counsel claiming that these important decisions, and Gateway Coal was, Chevron was content to say, we'll put them in the record, we'll acknowledge that they address it, but the board held that Chevron strenuously argued that the Gateway Coal standard was not met. This court cannot affirm on the ground that we agreed that the Gateway Coal standard was met because under the Chenery Doctrine, the board was explicit. We fought Gateway strenuously. We all know what the Gateway standard is. Nothing in that stipulation addresses the Gateway standard. If I could turn, however, to the second principal point I'd like to make today, which is that even supposing that there was protected activity here, this court has been clear that, as the Supreme Court has said as well, even when there is protected activity, employers have economic weapons in reserve that they can use to counteract that. To quote this court in the Local 702 case, quote, the fact that activity is protected does not insulate it from counteraction by the employer, end quote. American Shipbuilding, Brown, are very clear employers have to be able to do that.
Don't you run into another stipulation your client made, which is they agreed that the board would resolve this case under right line?
We don't believe that that has the consequence that the board does. The significance of right line is that it constituted the board's representation that it would not rely on a claim that what Chevron did was inherently destructive. Instead, it bore the burden of showing animus, which it has not shown, and it would be a perverse construction of sections 81 and 83 if employers were not able to raise their legitimate business reasons when their conduct was not inherently destructive.
You may well be right about that, but I was just asking whether or not your client's stipulation to trying this case before the board under right line precludes you from making that argument here. That's all.
Yeah, understood. And I think there's no way that could be, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Because, again, first of all, to say we're proceeding under right line is for the board to say we're not going to claim this is inherently destructive activity. It is indisputable under the labor laws, and they haven't contested, that employers may take economic measures in response to economic measures by a union. That's what the company did here. There is nothing in Rightline that prohibits asserting that defense. And if this court were to rule that an employer prosecuted under Rightline can't make that defense, it would be a radical change in labor law, because the board would proceed to bring cases like this under Rightline and say it doesn't matter whether it was a legitimate economic weapon. That's not a defense under Rightline. That's false. If you look at Rightline, page 1088, the board there specifically looked to Great Dane.
Well, I assume that employers in those situations wouldn't stipulate to trying it under Rightline. They would argue, as you have here, that the proper standard is Great Dane. Right? I mean, the problem is the stipulation. That's all I'm asking you. I mean, you can control.
The sentiment,
you can avoid the problem by not stipulating.
I don't think you could, Your Honor.
You couldn't?
No. Because Rightline is a test that's commonly used. There's no requirement of law that the board proceed under one standard or another. We are not attempting to insert the Great Dane standard here. We are calling upon principles of law that preceded Great Dane. They're in American Shipbuilding. They're in Brown. It is one of the fundamentals of American labor law that a company can push back when pushed economically. And again, it's at the board's discretion to bring a Rightline case. Consider a classic Rightline scenario where you've got dual motive, which I would suggest you have here. But the company has said we were pushing back on the economic weapon, but we also didn't want all of our employees to suffer the loss that resulted from a Memorial Day at one mine. So you had an economic pushback, and you had a legitimate concern. That's a classic Rightline dual motive type of defense. And what the board is telling you in this case, it is radical. What it is telling you is that when it proceeds under Rightline, there's no defense. So you look down the pike at other cases that would come before this court. You will hear it again if you construe Rightline in that way. The way you should interpret that concession is that it was the board's concession that it would not claim it was inherently destructive. And again, it would turn the labor laws on their head if legitimate business purposes were defense only when your conduct was inherently destructive, and never when there was a failure to show anti-union animus. And that's the final point that I'd like to emphasize now, which is that, again, the board has acknowledged, as it has to, that it bears the burden of persuasion throughout the case to show anti-union animus. It hasn't, and that's under Rightline. It hasn't done that, and for that reason, and because of the Gateway Coal standard, this court should vacate the decision below. I'll reserve the. I'll reserve for rebuttal if there are no questions.
Thank you,
Judge.
Yeah, thanks.
Good afternoon. I'm Mackenzie Phillip for the NLRB, and I'm here to ask you to enforce the board's order in full. Chevron regrets its litigation strategy before the board, and now it wants a do-over, but it is not legally entitled to one. Chevron stipulated that it amended its bonus plan in response to its employees' assertion of their right to take memorial periods, and it stipulated...
I read your argument about the modification of the plan. It didn't seem to me that really helps us at all. I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe their modification was not apt. That has nothing to do with the interpretation of the pre-existing memorial clause, Memorial Days clause.
Well,
right? So can't we focus on that?
Okay. Well, the company stipulated that it intended its amendment of the plan to deter its employees from asserting their right to engage in protected activity.
The first issue is, what does the pre-existing Memorial Days clause mean, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't win unless you win on that proposition.
Unless we win on the idea that going on memorial periods is protected activity?
Right.
And
the question is the relationship of it to the implied no strike clause, okay?
Okay.
So what's the argument exactly? Putting aside possible inaptness of Chevron's later modification of the provision.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand what your question.
In order for the board to prevail here, you have to convince the court that what the employees did here was protected by Section 7.
Right.
That is, that this was a permissible work stoppage under the Memorial Clause.
Right.
And what Judge Williams is asking you is that's the antecedent question to anything else. So you need to start there.
Okay. As the parties stipulated.
Because if it isn't protected, it doesn't make any difference if the employer right. said, we did this because they took Memorial Days. Right?
Yes, okay. I totally understand.
So let's start with the Memorial Clause.
Okay. And, so right. the Memorial Period provision of the contract says that the employees can take 10 Memorial Days per contract. And the parties, as you guys discussed just a few minutes ago, stipulated that the arbitration decisions and the West Virginia District Court decision addressed the history and purpose of the Memorial Period Clause.
And suppose you didn't have that. Suppose we didn't have that stipulation. Would the board's position be the same?
Yes.
So, all right, so that means that, let me make sure I understand that.
Well,
so
the clause.
You agree that this contract, this collective bargaining contract includes an implied no strike obligation, correct?
Yes, to a limited, well, yes.
Well.
There's an implied no strike.
The decision makes that quite clear.
Yeah. Yes. So we have an implied no strike obligation. So it's the board's theory that, now setting aside the stipulation, if it wasn't there, that one side of a contract can use a provision of the contract to violate another provision of the contract?
Well, it's not a violation. It wouldn't be a violation. The memorial period.
The employees could clearly take a Memorial Day off for purposes of mourning without violating the no strike obligation, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So the question is, in this case, is, and again, setting aside the stipulation, the question is, can they use it for purposes of undertake a work stoppage regarding an arbitrable issue? That's the question.
Right.
Namely, strike.
Right.
Even though there's a implied no strike obligation in the contract.
Right.
So that's what you need to focus on.
Right. And the memorial period provision negates to a limited extent the implied no strike clause.
You're saying it gives you 10 days
10
of
days.
Strikes? And what's the basis for that?
The plain language of the memorial period provision,
yes,
which says that they can.
You make the argument in your brief, and it's a classic argument, and it invokes a mm-hmm. general principle of the law, that there are many situations where language permits a party to do something for no reason or for any reason, but not for certain reasons that are forbidden. But that's a proposition of law that you invoke only when it works on your side, and you disregard totally in the context of the Memorial Periods Clause, as I may say, did the district court in Arch.
Well, as the parties stipulated, they...
They stipulated that the history and purpose of the clause was addressed.
Yes.
In those decisions, which is indisputably true. It was
yes.
addressed.
And
that doesn't make it gospel.
Right. Well, I think that as Judge Tatel said earlier, in the employer's brief to the board, it quoted those arbitration decisions and the West Virginia District Court decision as authoritative of explaining what the purpose and history of the Memorial Period Clause was. On page...
You speak as if purpose and history were sort of one discrete jewel of a thought, while in fact... Even if you look at only one of those decisions, Arch, it's sort of sprawling. That is to say, as counsel pointed out, it doesn't even address Gateway. It cites Gateway, to be sure, but it doesn't address what the relationship of the clause would be to the Gateway principle.
Well,
the requirement of express provision for something negating the no-strike obligation.
I agree that the legal reasoning of the West Virginia District Court case could be a little clearer. It cites Gateway and says there's an implied no-strike provision, but then it explicitly finds that the union can take memorial periods for whatever reason it wants, so it had to have found...
Whatever reason it wants is different from for forbidden reasons.
And in
did
that
you
case,
notice
it was
the dates,
forbidden
reasons. Did you notice the dates that the union took those memorial days?
In March? No, I'm sorry, I didn't.
They're the deer season.
Right. Right, they wanted...
It's entirely possible the court is just upholding the right to take Memorial Days for the deer season. Particularly in light of the court's complete failure to come to grips with the gateway issue.
Well, before the board, the employer cited ARCH and quoted from it, the memorial periods are contractually allowed authorized work stoppages. It quoted ARCH to the board. So now when it comes here and says that those memorial days or that those decisions are meaningless, it's a little hard to take.
That, as I recall, is literally what ARCH says. And its literal truth can be reconciled with Chevron's position here. They are work stoppages, right? They're authorized
contractually
work stoppages.
Authorized.
They're
exactly.
Contractually authorized work stoppages. Right. Not all presumably most contractually authorized work stoppages are not strikes. So the question is whether in this field of authorized work stoppages covered by the memorial periods clause, strikes are included, notwithstanding the no strikes clause.
Well, the
provision.
Okay. Well,
see, that's why I asked you how important the stipulation is to your argument, because I take it your response to our questions is we don't really have to decide any of those issues because here the employer agreed that the memorial clause could be used for just this purpose. That's your position.
That's correct. In fact, I shouldn't have been so adamant that the board would be in the exact same position if they hadn't made the stipulation. In fact, it's possible their argument about the reading of the memorial period provision is a reasonable position. And it's possible that if they hadn't stipulated that all these documents explain what the purpose and history of the memorial periods provision is, if they hadn't submitted all those and incorporated them into their stipulation, maybe we wouldn't be here. But they did stipulate that those documents address correctly. It was very much true.
Correctly.
It doesn't say correctly.
The stipulation says is the history and purpose were addressed.
But then they cite them. They quote them. They argue repeatedly that they're contractually authorized, that what the union did in 2004 was contractually authorized. The employer said it at least six times in its brief to the board. This dispute involves the consequences of the UMWA's exercise of its contractual right.
They made a different argument before the board than they're making here.
Right. They said that just because it's contractually protected does not make it Section 7 protected activity, but that is wrong. City disposal, the Supreme Court said that if it's in this collective bargaining agreement, it's protected by Section 7. Chevron seems to have missed that before the board, and I guess they regret missing that, but...
Can I get you to respond to Mr. Scalia's argument about the use of economic weapons here?
Yes. Parties may be entitled during bargaining for a successor contract to engage in economic weapons, but a company is not allowed to use economic weapons to selectively punish employees who assert a right that their union has already won for them in a collective bargaining agreement.
So you're distinguishing between a bargaining period and outside the bargaining period. Is that a legally significant difference for the law that's developed around use of economic weapons?
Well, all the Great Dane cases, all the cases talking about economic weapons are bargaining cases. They're bargaining for a successor contract. They're engaged in strikes and lockouts.
But has the court ever made that distinction that you're trying to urge upon us now, that's a legally significant difference?
No.
No, okay.
Not that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. But it is pretty clear. I mean, the company wants you to accept the fact that they say that they can use economic weapons because they have a substantial business reason for what they did. But a substantial business reason is not enough if you're also motivated by anti-union animus. In a Great Dane case where there is no evidence of animus, perhaps saying that you have a substantial business justification is enough when the board is only relying on an inference from the conduct itself.
But you're saying the stipulation 34, paragraph 34 here identifies that we know what was going on. It was more than business. It was retaliation.
Exactly. They explicitly said we're trying to deter employees from engaging in protected activity. We agree that they have the contractual right to assert to go on these memorial periods, but we can retaliate against them anyway.
They didn't say protected activity. They said for use of the memorial days, right?
Right. They said they're...
That gets us back to the original question.
What they admitted their contractual rights, though. Before the board, they never argued that they were barred by the contract.
Oh, I see. I see what you're saying. Okay.
They said they weren't Section 7.
Established rights.
Right. Okay. They said they weren't Section 7 rights, that you could retaliate against employees for asserting contractual rights, but not Section 7 rights.
Where in your brief do you invoke the Chevron's briefs arguments before the board, saying that the contract mm-hmm. authorized
it's on page 24.
These stoppages?
It's on page 24. The company's brief to the board acknowledged the union's right to use the memorial period provision as it did, stating by calling selective memorial days in 2004, the union utilized a contractual provision to place economic pressure on the company, and that the reasons for the union's decision to call selective memorial days at North River were immaterial to the question presented. They said it wasn't even relevant why the union went on these memorial periods. But now that's all they want this case to be about. It's inconsistent with what they said to the board. It's inconsistent with their stipulations. If there are no further questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So I guess we'll hear now from the union. Mrs. Cohen.
If it pleases this court, I'm Deborah Stern for the United Mine Workers. On November 1st, I will celebrate my 30th anniversary as counsel to the mine workers, so I have lived through a lot of...
Congratulations.
Thank you. A lot of collective bargaining agreements and a lot of strikes. Your Honor, the defenses urged by CMI just don't follow a logical trajectory at any point. If the union... Let's go to the deer hunting issue. Let's say the union, under the 2005 forfeiture amendment, would call a deer hunting day, or let's say three deer hunting days, at the CMA mines, but would not call deer hunting at all the district mines, the forfeiture would be triggered. Now, let's say the union would call 3 days of memorial periods at every district mine over an arbitrable issue, the forfeiture would not be triggered.
There's such inconsistency
in the factual arguments they make.
You're just saying, I guess that doesn't sound too persuasive to me. You're just saying that, they could have done it. They chose not to go as broadly as they think they could have.
What I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is that it boils down to this.
Is that your best argument, what you just said?
No.
Okay.
No, it's not my best argument. This is my best argument,
yeah.
And I will back up for a moment because I think anybody who was reading the papers in the 1960s may recall that there was a period of severe wildcat strikes in the late 60s through the coal fields. Uh-huh. In 1971, as stipulated, the Memorial Day provision, or the memorial provision, was first negotiated, and it allowed the union to call up to 10 days over the course of a contract, and that's approximately 2.5 days per most contracts run about 4 to 5 years. So 2 days a year. This is not a strike where
why'd
the
they
union
call it Memorial Days, memorial periods.
The union has always been very sensitive to the history of mine disasters, and there's just a long, frankly, the union has a long memory.
It was for memorials, right?
It was in 1971, it was negotiated after a period of terrible and very debilitating wildcat strikes through the coal fields. It was negotiated as a safety valve, as a pressure valve, that understood that miners were just simply getting angry about conditions, dropping their tools, walking off the job, and it was extremely disruptive to coal production, needless to say, and it was destructive on many levels, even to the union's administration of contracts. And there was a response to this in which everyone agreed, let's have a cooling off period, let's have a safety valve, approximately 2 days per year, no more than that. You can go out for any reason you want. And the union has utilized this as the cases and the arbitration decisions, which were stipulated to show, has utilized it in furtherance of disputes, which have been described as rather fractious by the district court. This is an important economic benefit that the union gained at the bargaining table. The company agreed to it, and I would tell you that in 2002 contract, under which this 2005 forfeiture clause was put into effect, the 2002 contract expired. CMI is now signatory to the 2007 contract, and that Memorial Day provision was carried over unchanged. It is presently in its contract. If the company asserts now this was unlawful activity, this violates a no strike clause, but in 2004 the company didn't file an unfair labor practice charge, it did not seek injunctive relief, it didn't seek damages, it didn't discipline employees, all of which would have been available to it.
You're saying there's an industry-wide knowledge of what this phrase means? I mean, yes. It's a term of memorial periods, is a term of art that everyone
Absolutely.
Knows what it means?
Absolutely, there's an industry. To be able to close a mine for 2 days is not a small matter. Mm-hmm. There, I cannot imagine a company the size of CMI, Consolidation Coal Company, Arch, not understanding what this means when it signs onto it. And it's carried over. It's 1971 through the present. It's still in the contract that CMI is signatory to. And they absolutely understood what it means. And they know that this is a pressure valve that allows certain resolution of disputes. And frankly, it also...
I guess that's your explanation for there being... only one decision, a district court decision, which even begins to sort of ruminate around the general problem of the interaction of this with Gateway.
Your Honor, the union is not going to shut down coal production to go deer hunting. It might be deer hunting season, and that might be a good time to try to get something resolved, because you can say everybody get to spend a day going deer hunting while we get this thing figured out. But there is also a notice requirement. The union has to provide notice. Part of that pressure valve is that where a dispute builds up to such a point, even with grievance arbitration, it's kind of reaching a boiling point, the union calls ahead, says we are going to take a Memorial Day. And frankly, more often than not, things do get resolved. It leads, if nothing else, to some very intense and quick discussions. Can we get this matter figured out? I mean, it has a utility and it has a purpose for both sides. In 2007, when the contract was up again, CMI could have bargained to impasse on it. It could have filed charges. It could have said, look, this is a demand to have a no-strike provision. We won't agree to it. We're going to go to impasse. The union can't strike over it. None of that happened. I mean, frankly, that conduct, combined with these stipulations, is just admission after admission after admission against their interest and in favor of the union's position.
Anything else? Nope. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Does Mr. Scalia have any time left? You can have your minute. You can even have two.
Thank you very much. Judge Tatel, Judges Griffith and Williams, the burden lies with the board on this one under Gateway Coal. I've cited other provisions of Gateway Coal.
Let me ask you to address the economic weapons point. Counsel for the NRB suggested that even though the cases don't say this expressly, if you look at them carefully, that one can draw a distinction between bargaining period and
There's no basis for that assertion at all, Your Honor. I would say two things to that. First of all, if there were a strike for recognitional purposes, there's just no way that the employer's hands would have to be tied and it couldn't counteract. The reason you generally don't find cases outside those two contexts is because what they're urging here is so exceptional. That is, that you've got a company with a contract, so they're not in bargaining. And yet, nonetheless, 10 days out of the year, they have to stand down while they lose as much as $415,000 a day. That's a cost, the high-end cost of just one of these Memorial Days. The idea that a company has to stand down while there's a pending grievance. Suppose there's $20,000 in dispute on the grievance. The company's right. Their position is the company can be forced to stand down. And remember, 10 days is a practical matter, a lot more than 10 days. Because the threat alone can be enough to cause the company to yield. Now, coming back to Gateway Coal, the burden's on them. Footnote 10, only the most forceful evidence of a purpose to exclude the claim from arbitration can prevail, particularly, they say, when the clause is vague. We heard the board concede our interpretation is reasonable. We think they misconstrued the stipulation, but they can hardly claim it's clear. If the stipulation is vague, the burden remains on them. Doubts are resolved in our favor. The stipulation cannot bear the weight that they're trying to give it here, and Gateway Coal is clear. If there is vagueness, if there is doubt, it's in our favor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.